These recordings have been copied on the 24th of April 1997 by Rolf Rolling at Irene Avenue in Lansing. I own the original tapes of Freddie's talks, and I have recorded several copies for friends who remembered Fred, or, as he was known, Nobby. I'm sure he would be pleased to know that he can still be remembered in this way, and the sound of his Sussex voice can still be heard and enjoyed. This next tape is about Bungalow Town on Shoreham Beach. I hope you enjoy it.
Neb Walter's book, The Filmmakers of Bungalow Town, covers an era from 1900 to 1930. At his suggestion, I have recalled some of the events that took place while I was employed at the boatyard on the southern riverbank near the chemical works. I started work on the 17th of February 1941. 7:15 on that Monday morning saw me halfway across the Shoreham footbridge. To get that far, I had to show the sentry in the old toll collector's room at the town end of the footbridge a pass. I had gone to Shoreham Town Hall during the previous week and received a temporary document, which was later replaced by the real thing from my new employer. There were only two industries on the beach during the war: the chemical works, which mainly processed material from the Portslade gasworks, and the Sussex shipworks, later to become the Sussex Shipbuilding Company. After the war it became James Taylor of Chertsey, and finally Watercraft, until demolition in 1987, when a start was made on a marina and housing complex. This yard was to be my place of employment for the next 9 years. Shoreham Beach was known as Bungalow Town until after World War II, because it was just what the name implies, a town of mostly wooden bungalows. A large percentage were made by obtaining two old railway carriage bodies, which were pulled across the river at low tide by horses. They were set up about 10 feet apart and a roof put over the top, and some had a balcony built across the front. There were a few brick bungalows and a few houses. The biggest building must have been the Tudor House pub, which is now known as the Lady Jane. After the evacuation of Dunkirk in May 1940, it was expected and later proved that part of the German invasion would be centred in this area. All the inhabitants who lived between the river and the sea and the Church of the Good Shepherd and the Widewater were moved out, and most of the buildings were blown up by the Canadians. I think only the brick-built buildings in Riverside and Shingle Road, a few in Ferry Road and the Old Fort Road were spared. The whole area was fenced with rolls of concertina barbed wire and sown with landmines. This action gave the guns in the hills a clear view of the sea. Unfortunately, not all the guns were guns. A lot were just cartwheels on axles with a scaffold pole laid across and covered with camouflage netting to give the reconnaissance aircraft the impression we were better armed than we were. The Church of the Good Shepherd is not an ancient building and was due to be demolished. However, the commanding officer of the Canadian Regiment found his men using the church for services and decided to spare it, and locals were later issued with special passes during the war so that they could still attend what was their normal peacetime church. A lot of the boards from the blown up bungalows were used to line trenches that were dug inland as a second line of defence. But of course Shoreham should now be a bit safer because of the wire and the mines. However, as history will now show, The only casualties that resulted from the mines were not the enemy. The boatyard workers were having midday lunch at the south end of the shops one day, when a soldier started to walk towards them from the Old Fort Road. He crossed the barbed wire at the end of Shingle Road. There may well have been a gap there. The workmen waved at him to go back. He, thinking they were waving a greeting, waved back, carried on walking, and was killed. A shipyard worker, Jack Walker, was also killed when he went into an old garden to pick flowers. The beach became inhabited by a colony of rabbits who were not heavy enough to activate the mines. But a lot of the dogs that crossed the river and chased them found the extra weight and finished as puffs of smoke drifted over the shingle. The sentries at the town end of the footbridge were one night surprised to find a lorry driver walking towards them. He had received directions from the sentries at King's Drive near the Church of the Good Shepherd, but in the dark he had driven off the road through the minefields and had become bogged down by some old tennis courts. The following morning, a Canadian remarked he could see the tracks in the shingle, and logic said that he could reverse the lorry back the way the driver had come in. He proved his theory and lived. But early on that February morning, as I came to the end of the bridge, there was nothing between me and the sea except barbed wire and red and white notice board saying, "Danger, mines, keep out." It was typical of the workers of the day that no one seemed to worry about the possibility of danger until, just before the Normandy landings, a large contingent of Scottish boilermakers arrived to work on the landing barges. They, seeing the warning boards, immediately demanded threepence per hour danger money, plus threepence an hour dirty money, and threepence an hour away from homeowners. And, to the disgust of the men who had worked on the beach from the beginning, got what they asked for. The yard was actively engaged in building and repairing armed motor launches, motor gunboats, motor torpedo boats, and 35 and 45 foot picket and pinnace boats. A Royal National lifeboat was built, and several others followed after the war. A large number of men were engaged on repairs to boats damaged in action. It was sometimes unbelievable that some of the boats were able to get back to port. As the gunboats had wooden hulls, once away from the scene of battle, a leak could often be stopped by nailing a wooden patch over the hull with a bit of paint-soaked rag underneath it. For a boat to have 20 or 30 patches was not unusual. Boats that had been badly shot up were known as Peter Scots by some workers. He was well known for his exploits as a gunboat skipper, and he is said to have jumped off at the locks at Southwick and demanded a new boat so that he could get back to sea before the tide turned. True or not, he did not deny it when I inquired a few years ago. Of course, as the war progressed, new techniques came into being, and extra guns, radar, and insulation against the cold were fitted. Also, if the boat was going to the tropics, copper sheeting was fixed to the bottom as a protection against the Tirado shipworm. One of the memorable features of the boatyard workers during the war was the craftsmanship that was employed to do a good job, even though the boats were not expected to last very long. No bodging or shortcuts. A man would face the wrath or ridicule of the rest of the yard if his tools were not up to scratch or he did not do a good job. Everyone seemed to whistle or sing, and it should be remembered that the long hours worked were not the end of the day. There was home guard, civil defence or fire watch, a compulsory addition to a man's war effort. It was fire watch which resulted in the only death that occurred in the yard during the war. Although it was against the laid down rules for a worker to board His Majesty's ships after working hours, the fact that tea and sugar rations were issued to the boats, although some crew members were on leave, meant a good cup of tea was nearly always available. And to some extent, the management closed their eyes as a type of reward for the efforts that the workers made. But on one very dark night, a worker came up from a lighted mess deck and before his eyes became accustomed to the light, tried to find a ladder and fell some 20 feet to his death. Some of the workers were great practical jokers. No harm was done, and it brought a little humour to what was, in some respects, quite a hard life. It was unwise to kick at an empty screw packet that lay on the floor. It was probably masking a block of wood that was nailed to the floor underneath. Similar treatment was given to an old hack, and the unwise finished with a bruised toe. There were some very colourful characters amongst the staff, none more so than Tom the Rigger. I first met him when I unknowingly walked under an engine he was lifting on the travelling crane. I heard a voice roaring at me, and I was confronted by a man swinging at me on the end of the endless chain which worked the hoist. To me, on my first day at work, he was almost a frightening figure. A gold earring was not often seen in a man at that time, and the wad of what I was later to learn was chewing tobacco behind that same ear gave me no comfort. A battered yachting cap and jersey with a pair of seaman's trousers held up by a knife-carrying belt completed his dress. It was a very cold February, but he was barefoot, and I was later to see him wade barefoot into the icy water to check a winch wire at the end of the slipway. His knife was the biggest I've ever seen, and the sheath was made from an old railway window strap. He seemed to have an endless supply of sheaths, and the pattern he cut got rid of the SR, and the holes became stars. He looked at me for a while and started to swear at me in every language he had learnt on his worldwide travels. "Don't ever walk under a load that I'm lifting, or anyone else comes to that," he yelled. "If anything snaps, we will have to sweep you up off the floor." It was a bit of a harsh lesson, but I've never walked under a swinging load since. The 35 and 45 footers were built upside down, that is, until they were planked and given a coat of paint and filler. It was quicker and easier to work on the top of a job rather than underneath it. Tom used to rig the gear to turn the hull over, ready for decking and cabins, etc. He would put two rope slings around the hull. One would be fixed to the overhead crane and the other to a hand winch. Tom would stand on the upturned keel and work the endless chain on the crane, at the same time giving signals to the men on the winch. When he judged the hull to be high enough, men would lift on one side of the gunwale, and Tom would run around the side of the hull like a circus acrobat on a ball. Tom left the yard to go to sea, and his place was taken by an equally picturesque character, Don Wilson. He was a man of uncertain age. If there had been a competition for the man with the longest handlebar moustache, he must have been one in the running. He was an ex-master mariner, and the best forecaster of the day's weather I ever met. If he said it would rain at 4 o'clock, it would rain without doubt. If by some odd remark you mentioned the position of the sun or a star at a certain time of day, he would cover his loft floor with chalk arcs and crosses to explain the phenomenon. For a man who had never been to school, he was very well educated. On several occasions I picked up a wire splice and looked at it before it was parceled against the weather, but it was impossible to trace the way he had threaded the strand. After the war, he was told to use a derrick that the engineers had built to put a mast into a yacht. He refused, saying it was unsafe. After being threatened with the sack by the manager, he walked back up the slipway, shaking his head. When the rig collapsed, he did not even look back. But next day he showed me, with his massive chalk marks on the floor, why it had collapsed and how it could have been rigged to have worked safely. When a man has lifted material on and off ships all his working life, all over the world, it does not pay to argue. One of the strongest men I ever met was Buller Parsons. Before the war, he had poled barges up and down the river after filling them with sand which he shoveled out of the banks at low tide. This was mainly used in foundries for casting. With Tom the rigger, he usually got the boats ready for launching or re-slipping. And he had his own little claim to fame, because on one occasion, four men were trying to get a baulk of timber out from under a kill, and found it would not move. Buller was on the other end, trying to get it out on his side. Of course, a chapter could be written about all the jokers, who had their own party tricks. And then there were the older men, like Mo Slaughter, whose cap peak faced the front at 7 in the morning, but it somehow strayed over one ear by 5 o'clock in the afternoon. He had sailed boats and regattas from Stowe's yard on the other side of the river, with their bottoms gleaming with Stowe blacklead to give them extra speed. He had played cricket for Shoreham before they moved to Buckingham Park, and they played on Beach Green by the riverside. Because of the shingle under the grass, a concrete strip was laid down on top of a thick layer of cow manure, so that when the coconut matting was laid on top, there was more chance of an even bounce. The blacksmith was Bill Best, a big man with bulging eyes caused by peering into the smoking fire. When he hardened a tool, he dropped dust from a little box he had into the fire, and he disappeared in a shower of sparks like some ancient wizard. But the finished tool defied any file or drill. Bill Emery, the charge hand, was known as the Widow, and he had the knack of tripping over the same winch wire every morning as he walked down the yard rolling a cigarette. Of course, there were not enough boat builders in the area to fill the 3 yards in the port, and carpenters and joiners were directed by the Ministry of Labour into the industry. They were known as dilutees, and because they were familiar with working with wood, once they had been shown the methods required, they were able to do just as good a job as the boat builders. There was also a wheelwright and 2 coffee makers and aircraft workers. In fact, anyone who was a tradesman in wood was likely to become a boat builder. By an ironic twist, several local boat builders were sent to Portsmouth to work on the Mulberry harbours, which were built ready for the Normandy invasion. One of the most important things to point out about the yard was its position. It was obviously built by the water's edge. At high tide, the water came well up into the shops. The sea was not too far away to the south. The shops themselves were quite high and had a concrete floor. To enable finished boats to be launched, there were great sliding doors at the north end. The tracks that the doors ran on had great holes cut under them to accommodate the winch wires. Therefore, when it was cold and the wind blew from the north, it was very cold. Even the carpenters, who'd worked all their working life on building sites, complained about the cold. Being between the river and the sea, the atmosphere was always damp and penetrating. It was a good walk from Shoreham to the yard, and one could get very wet on the way to work. There was no way of drying clothes, and one often stayed wet all day. The compressed air system would freeze, and the handheld drills would have to be taken into the blacksmith shop to thaw out. It was not a comfortable place to work. The yard was enlarged as the war got underway. A large bandsaw was added to the mill. This was mainly used for cutting logs or bulks into planks and boards. The bottom wheel of the saw worked in a pit, and a travelling bed running both sides of the saw made slicing up a log quite easy. There was always the odd occasion when cutting up English trees to come across pieces of wire which were the remains of fences, sometimes nailed to the tree many years ago. Oft times the saw would break and some 20 feet of saw would fly through the air. It was the bandsaw which led to a minor scandal. The saw operator was given some sizes for some teak boards. He was one of a Lancing family of undertakers. There was also a coffin maker in the joiner's shop. After consultation between the two, they asked who the coffin boards were for, and not getting a direct answer, watch was kept, a van was followed, and later the works owner, a local undertaker and a local farmer were prosecuted for illegal use of Admiralty timber. There were two big holes in the shingle bank. Like small creeks, they were known as the guts, which is another name for small channels. Both eventually became slipways. The westerly one could accommodate 5 112-foot motor launches. By pulling the boats out of the water and striking them sideways, there was room for two each side and one on the centre cradle. They were presided over by a large radial jib crane capable of servicing all the five boats. Just after the war, the wire that went over the king post to lift the jib was affected by the salt air and snapped. The jib, which had lifted a 3-ton engine the day before, fell between three big yachts and a motor launch being converted for an engine showroom. Although the jib took the shape of a snake as it bedded itself over the slipway cradle, no one was hurt. Had it fallen a few yards left or right, it could have been a very different story. The fire slip held two landing craft and was mainly the area worked by the Scottish boilermakers. Barges were also moored by the side of the jetty, and as the tide rose, crabs started to run around in the shallow water. The electric arc welders, who had had to wait for the plates to be lifted into place, would drop their rods over the side, and as the water made a perfect earth, they would chase the crabs with a mild electric shock. The footbridge was of course a key factor in getting to work. The nearest bus stop was in Shoreham. Some workers came by train to Shoreham Station. It was a long way round to the yard via the Norfolk Bridge, King's Drive and the Old Fort Road, and it caused quite a good deal of concern when the centre span was found to be unsafe and the bridge threatened with closure. After a mild threat of a strike, the Royal Engineers came to the rescue with a section of Bailey Bridge, which remained in place until it was removed for use in the Normandy landing. The span was strengthened with tubular scaffolding until after the war, when it was closed for 3 weeks while the cementation company brought it back up to scratch. But by then a bus ran from Shoreham to the beach, so there was no problem in getting to work. Of course, it is now no secret that Matlows were always ready to make a few bob, and issues of rum and tobacco changed hands. Also, as I've mentioned earlier, full rations were often issued to boats, even though some of the crew members were on leave. And the odd tins of beans or meat were purchased with speed by workmen on the right boat at the right time. Black oar skins were also much sought after by men working outside. Inspectors got perks from the officers by getting extra work done in the wardroom. Oerlikon gun shell cases that were often found on the deck had a penny soldered on the end, and with the addition of a flint wheel were turned into lighters. Timber began to get short at the end of the war. Boats that had been planked with mahogany had to be satisfied with larch, and the blackout shutters were taken down to allow the timber to be put to better use. Logs were floated across the river with the leaves still growing from the bark. The boards had to be used directly they were cut, or they would twist so much they would be unusable. The shrinkage in hot weather was so much that joints that were tight one day would have a gap big enough to put a rule through within a couple of days. And at the end of the war, material was so scarce that there was a limit on the type of work that could be done anyhow. Luckily, contracts for several Royal National lifeboats were secured and kept a fair nucleus of men working. The lifeboat institution, of course, supplied the timber. Three yachts, which were prizes of war, were some of the first post-war boats to be slipped. They were once Hitler's Staff's ocean racers. They were the Skaterack, the Kattegat and the Nordwind. A lot of Thames lighter barges had had ramps built into their bows for use as landing barges. They were converted back to their original state to be returned to commercial use and kept a few boilermakers in Sussex for a bit longer. An ex-112-foot gunboat was converted into a showboat for GEC engines, and to complete the job, wartime jetty piles were pulled out of the mud and cut into battens in the mill. The boat builders had always had to work in iron, brass and copper as well as wood, and then another material, tax their abilities. It was an aluminium alloy called Bermabrite. Two fast launches were built for a Venezuelan oil company who had a rig in the middle of a lake. This material was later used to build an ocean racer for the owner of the yard, Mr. Rawlings. This was quite a revolutionary boat for its day and won the Cowes Dinard race within a few days of completion. It ran into a severe squall in the fast net race. Waves were as high as the top crossbeams and it had to withdraw after damage to the mast. She was shipped to America to take part in the Newport to Bermuda and the Bermuda to Plymouth race and was one of the fastest boats to cross the Atlantic at that time. The mines were cleared from the beach and the old bungalow gardens. A big pump was set up in the river and the high pressure jets were used to move the shingle and expose the deeply buried mines. It was a little unnerving to see the engineers pick them up like footballs and toss them in a heap. Wartime techniques had ruled out the use of barges in the river, but the mighty Bullet was soon at work digging out mud berths for the now familiar houseboats, which were converted from redundant gunboats. The occupants of the bungalows, which had not been blown up, returned and the pub reopened. Summertime saw the locals returning to the seaside for the first time since Dunkirk, and the annual river regatta again provided a weekend entertainment. The chemical works closed down and were demolished. A bit of Shoreham history vanished, but new wharves and warehouses took its place. The old wooden bungalows were replaced with more conventional buildings, and Shoreham Beach became a little town all of its own once again.
And now may I introduce myself once again. My name is Rolf, and I would like to add a postscript about Fred and myself. He was a shipwright by trade and training, and as such was an excellent craftsman in wood. We met first in the boatyard in Shoreham in 1948, and our paths seemed to meet and cross, and our friendship developed, mainly through our love of the country and of Sussex, and to our shared interest in old Sussex churches. He gave me most of my knowledge of Sussex, and in turn he shared my knowledge of churches and their history. When he was forced to give up work, and I retired from my occupation, we went out regularly, either on a Friday or a Sunday afternoon. After his last open-heart surgery, he was unable to even leave his home. I still miss his enthusiasm and company. Nobby Clark, may he rest in peace in Sussex.